Here he is, Lieutenant Colonel Rob Mellon. I'm standing at attention as I say this on the Mary Griffith Show. Mary Griffith Show brought to you by Harvest Ridge Coffee. Welcome to the Mary Griffith Show, Rob.
Thank you.
It is so great to have you here, and we are going to get to the Historical Society of Quincy and Adams County. But I want to talk first about your military career, because you, I mean, my uncles are all passed now. My dad's gone. You're the closest thing I know to somebody who's, like, career military. And I'm fascinated by, don't take this the wrong way, because you're a very bright guy, how the hell long it takes to get up the, you know, at the rate you're going, Rob. You may not make four-star general.
That's
I don't know how
true.
To break
yes,
it to
I,
you.
No, I'm aware.
So I want to talk a little bit about you are now a lieutenant colonel. The only other lieutenant colonel I'm familiar with is Donald Penobscot, Hot Lips' fiance in MASH.
Oh, okay, yes.
So he was not a nice guy, but you are a nice guy.
Yes, I try to be.
You would
yes.
never be mean to Margaret Houlihan, would you?
No.
So you've had some interesting jobs, though, as you have climbed the career ladder. What is your job classification? What is it you do for the military?
Currently, right now, well, I'm in the Army Reserve, and I've
right.
been in the
Army. It's not like you're out, you know. Yeah, you're not. You don't have a gun with you today. Well, at least you're not supposed to.
Yeah,
but
right.
Who knows? He may be concealed carry. I don't know.
So, in the currently in the Army Reserve, I'm an instructor for the majors who are studying to become lieutenant colonels in the Army. It's called ILE. And it's through the Command and Joint Staff College, which is in Fort Leavenworth. So that's our bosses at Fort Leavenworth. And we teach that to reserve and guard majors trying to become lieutenant colonel. So that's my current position right now.
Okay. But what did you do before you were an instructor?
Because
you were like on the ground. You went overseas and you...
Yeah. I've done many things.
Well, hit the highlights.
Hit the highlights.
Hit the things you can tell us. Because I'm sure you're sitting there going, Mary... If I tell you, I'll have to kill you.
Okay. Well, I joined the Army in 1994, so I've been in one capacity or another since 1994. My first job was as a voice intercept, so I was a military intelligence person, and we intercepted voice communications. Now, my job specifically at that time was mainly counter-narcotics, so I had learned Spanish, and I was intercepting communications in Colombia and Cuba and things like that.
So you were
that.
Defending
so
our country,
job.
But not from people who were trying to go to war with us, people who were putting drugs into our economy trying to hurt us in that manner.
Yeah, and it's a real tricky situation because the military can't serve as a police force, so it's more as a support to give information to law enforcement. And we had these capabilities back then where we could intercept communications. Now those capabilities are, you know, you hear about them all the time.
Yeah, now I could do it.
Yes, now yeah. an individual.
But you had to be fairly fluent in Spanish and really in guttural Spanish, because my cousin Peggy was a nun for a while, and she not only speaks Spanish, but she speaks that what they call gutter or street level or, you know, low class Spanish. I mean, this is not people, you don't learn this out at Quincy High School in Spanish class. You have to learn like the lingo and the street level.
Right.
So you have to know some terminology.
We had to know the terminology based on the drug trade. So if they would call something, a cargo or something, it would mean something else. And
right.
so like we had to know all of those things that were words, cover words or words they used or slang words for materials to make, you know, narcotics and things like
kind
that.
Kind of like...
That was my first job in the Army.
The opposite, in a sense, of being a Navajo code talker, which the Army recruited those people...
Certainly.
...to go in and speak their own language because the Japanese could never figure out what
That's
they were
correct.
Talking about. They didn't even have to speak in code. They just talked to each other in their own native language.
That's
and
right,
nobody
and they
could
never
ever,
did.
Yeah,
the
they
Japanese
never did break the...
Never able,
never able to break
that.
The code. Okay, so you worked in...
So that was my first job.
So you helped keep drugs out of our country. But you didn't
sure.
do it by... arresting anybody. You did it by providing military intelligence to private sector law enforcement.
Yes, people who did not know that we were listening to conversations, we just, you know,
could have been a news
in.
Reporter then. That's what my that's my forte. Okay.
Then so that was my first job, and then I went to Officer Candidate School at Fort Benning, which is called Fort Moore now, and I became an officer, became a field artillery officer. I went to Korea, so I was on the DMZ for a while.
Now, what was that like? Were you scared? Well, that's a silly question.
Not really.
But I mean, did you stand there, like, staring at somebody 100 yards away? Or did you work like
generally?
Not
like
generally.
We stay.
Yeah.
You know, there's an. I was in missile launchers at the time.
So you weren't right there. You had to be back a few feet.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty interesting though, because to practice, we would go way up by the DMZ and turn south, because you can't have the practice rounds inadvertently land in North Korea. That
right.
would not be good.
That would cause a probable incident.
That's right.
So who were you then sending these missiles towards, out in the
no,
ocean?
No, we were just
practicing.
We were practicing and preparing. You know, that's a real world event. So, you know, we would do these situations where we would have alerts and we would start to head out to our battle positions, like which would be our actual battle positions if something happened in Korea. And then we were just that's what they're doing in Korea probably today. The circumstance in Korea is much different, because back then they had scattered forts and camps all over the place of varying size. Some were really small, some were a little larger. Now they've consolidated into a place called Camp Humphreys, which is much larger, and pulled back a little bit from the DMZ, where we were up closer to the DMZ at that time, and that was in the 90s, so that was a minute ago.
Yeah, you're an old man. We've established it. You're very old. Rob Mellon, my guest today, Lieutenant Colonel Rob Mellon. So that was interesting. You got to stay some time in Korea and get to learn a little bit about the people and the culture there. Were you isolated on the base, or were you able to walk freely around in South Korea and kind of...
No, we could go out into the village. In fact, it was, you know, the nature of that circumstance at the time, there'd be an army base or camp, and then right outside of it, there would be a village which would almost service the camp.
Right.
And there were things in there that would appeal to soldiers. You know, there were some tailors, there were some bars, there were some things.
there were some things that would appeal to soldiers.
That's right.
Rosie's Bar, kind of like in MASH, okay?
And
yeah.
So you had an interesting dynamic there.
Were you a married man at that time?
I was, yes.
Okay, so you didn't know about anything but the tailor shop.
That's
okay,
right.
That's good.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely.
You know,
okay.
There was an interesting circumstance which happened, which if I was the officer on duty that night, there was a curfew. So you'd have to go down into the, which we called the Ville, you'd have to go down into the Ville and clear out all the bars. And some of these bars are pretty interesting. And you're walking in uniform and telling the soldiers, hey, it's time to get back on, you know, get
on
back
base.
In through the gate. Because if you're not, then you're automatically going to get in trouble. Like you're going to get UCMJ action taken against you if you don't get back in time. So it was that was part of our duty. So I'd been throughout the whole Ville, you know, at that
so
time.
So you were forced. As part of your duty to go to some unsavory places.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you for your service.
So that was all my active time. That was back when I was on... Now, I've done active time since then, but right. That was when I was on active duty as a young man, straight out of Quincy University, and mm-hmm. I was a disc jockey for a little bit, and then...
In the Army?
No. At 99Q back in the day.
Rob Mellon, our sister station, I did not know that.
Way back in the day, and Scott was there. And Guy Dye was
Guy
there.
Guy Dye?
Yeah.
Oh, my
gosh. Simon Will was
Well, then I was there. Sign. I was here. How come I don't remember you?
Yeah, it was, you know, even Reggie.
No, I got here in 1987. Where is it before then?
It was 93.
Well, why don't I know you?
92.
You must have worked a shift opposite of mine.
I worked midnight to 6.
Yeah, I didn't see you. Okay.
Yeah, I'm a young college kid.
I was we have a, if you'd like to resume your radio career, we have openings on Saturday and Sunday morning, so we'll talk later.
Okay.
Okay. Wow, that's...
Probably not.
My God, how could I not have known that?
That was a long time ago.
Now, you're very good. No wonder you're so good in your podcasting and your radio work here. You have experience.
Well, I learned from really good guys
Reggie
like
Coleman.
Simon and Reggie and... Jeff Dorsey was around,
okay.
And Scott, you know. So there were some really talented people back then.
Wow. I was around then, too, but
I wasn't
our talents
one.
Never our talents never met. Okay.
So that from that, I joined the Army, and that was my... And then when I got out of the Army, I was in the Illinois National Guard. And so I've been in, at this point, the active duty side and the National Guard. And in 2009... I got into the reserves, and since I've been in the reserves, we ran basic training for a number of years. So that's when I got called to active duty. I went to Saudi Arabia as part of a mission in Saudi Arabia. And then I came back for a while, and then I went to Germany. And that was kind of working mainly on what you can imagine is going on in Eastern Europe right now. That was kind of our focus. And then I worked last year in Chicago with FEMA preparing for the political conventions, like the things that would happen that most people wouldn't consider, like dirty bombs and, you know, chemical attacks. You know, really, when America has its worst day is what we would say. That's when we would be called into action on America's worst day.
So you are fully trained and ready, willing, and able to go into those roles when that unfortunate, unspeakable thing would happen. I know you talked a little bit about your Saudi Arabia involvement, and it's always interesting when an American serviceman is in a, quote, allied country, but they're not that close of friends to us, are they? Well, it's an interesting situation.
I got this. I'll tell you one little interesting story. There was I was the commander, and we were responsible for training these Saudi troops. And one of my interpreters, we had 9 interpreters. We were teaching English to them, too. So we had a large footprint. I was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And so my interpreter comes up and, like, this group of Saudi trainees or whatever is not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So I'm like, okay, I can fix that. So I said, when I walk in there, I'm going to give them trouble because they don't stand at the position of attention. Now, they're not going to know any better. So I walked in and I just lit into them. You know, because they weren't showing up on time. And so and these are Saudi.
It's people like, excuse
these
me.
These are not American soldiers.
I could buy and sell you.
So I walked in and I let them have it. I'm like, an officer comes in the room and you're not at the position of attention. And then they started chirping back at me. And then I told it through the interpreter, I'm like, this is a one-way conversation. Like, this is not a two-way conversation. And then so I kind of lit into them to kind of get them refocused on their training. Well, the next day we were at the rifle range. My demeanor changed a little because some of these characters are, you know, some of them are not as aligned with the United States as you would hope they would be. And so when I was at the rifle range, my tact was a little different. I'm like,
you told me that
excellent
it was
work.
Yeah, you told me at the rifle range it was a little bit disconcerting to go with people that may not be the friendliest to you and they have weapons. It
especially after I just lit into them the day before.
And
so.
Especially since, and I mean, you know, that everybody's got their right to their religious principles, but like some of those people were probably members of the royal family because they've got 100,000 kids, you know.
Fascinating. I mean,
they've got 28,000 wives, so you know they have 18 million princes. They could have just been like off with your head.
Well, the families are what's truly important, and it goes back to like when they had, because they're in clans.
Right.
And
so the Saud family, it's not called Saudi Arabia for no reason.
Right.
If you're a Saud, you know what Rob Mellon yelling at you.
And if you were aligned with them even decades and decades ago, and you were a family that wasn't, but now you're all in the army, in their military, and let's say you're a family that hadn't decades ago, not in modern times, supported the Saud family, then, you know, even if you were a sergeant, a private would be like, I'm not listening to you, you know, because you're not from the right family. So they have a dynamic there, which is we're not accustomed to in the American Army. So it was interesting.
I bet it was. He toned his tone down just a little bit when he got them weapons. Okay.
Yes.
And then, so talk a little bit about your work there then it was in Chicago. In Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Were both conventions? No, where were the conventions? The Republican was in Chicago.
No, the Republican was in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee. They were close to Chicago. Okay.
That's right.
You worked on both of them,
that's
I understand.
Right, yes.
Okay. So the Republican was in
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee. And the mm-hmm. Democrat was in Chicago.
That's right.
But you worked on both of them. And so, mm-hmm. without giving away trade secrets, obviously, but a large group of our elected officials at any time are in these two convention halls.
That's right.
All the people who are movers and shakers in one of the parties. I mean, it would be devastating to our way of life and our government if an entire top sector of Democrats and or Republicans was taken out, or God forbid, both. So you had
at the conventions, you also have all the delegates, which are these supporters that go down to the local level.
That's what
and
I mean.
State
the whole
level.
Party.
So if something
the whole party
there,
alignment
that's
is
right.
gone.
It's
I mean,
not just the elected officials.
You're going to lose the head of the Republican Party in Adams County.
That's right.
You know, you're going to lose everybody.
That's right.
Thank you, Kent Snyder. Rob Mellon saved your life.
I would not say that, but I was there in case.
But like things like Melania's big hat, you know, we didn't know what was under there. So you have to, you know, do things like that. So what did you do? Where were you?
So when I was at in Milwaukee, the idea behind this is when you set up with FEMA, FEMA's there just as a contingency in case something really terrible happens. Doesn't have to be a terrorist attack or anything of that nature, or like a massive chemical attack.
It could have been a tornado yeah. or a water supply system.
That's
that
right.
was just
yeah.
like somebody got botulism in the water. It wasn't even put there by a terrorist, just anything that could have happened.
So the challenge that FEMA has is they don't have a lot of equipment. And so, for example, if they have to move a lot of people, they have to figure out a way to do it. Now, they can hire trucks to do it themselves, but a lot of times they'll turn to the military and say, can you provide some trucks, for example? So that's kind of the idea. That was just one example, but that's kind of the idea where FEMA would come to the military, and we're embedded with FEMA, so in case the request comes, we're right there ready to action those requests for soldiers, support, medical support, all kinds of things.
Okay. So you are part of the readiness force. Now,
that's right.
You are back in the...
Removed from the site because
right. well,
they
yeah.
do a blast radius study, and they determine what the blast radius and the effects of, say, a dirty bomb would be, mm-hmm. and then you have to set up outside of that.
So you're a chicken is basically what you're saying. You I'd like to volunteer for this duty. And I want to become a colonel, but I don't want to actually
right on the outskirts of danger.
Anywhere where there's danger. I'd like to be
right
outside the blast radius.
I'll be right up to danger, but not in danger.
I'll be in my lead suit so radiation doesn't hit me, and then I will take command and control everything. Good for you.
So that's what we did. And we were there just in case something terrible would happen. We had military working dogs. We had aviation support. We had those who are nuclear, biological, chemical teams that were set up just in case something like that happened, decontamination type of capabilities. Because in a massive event like that, it would be a mess.
Yeah. Is it, you can use this now in your everyday life as executive director of the Quincy Historical Society, because whenever Jack Freiberg and Lynn Neewarner are in the same room, there could be an event that would require a mass evacuation and or, you know, a dirty bomb going off, right?
That's right.
So at board meetings, you're like, I'm tough, and I'm ready to decontaminate this whole organization if you let me, right? I love it. Well, Rob, we're going to get to the Historical Society, but I just find it fascinating. Run real quick. You've made Lieutenant Colonel. And I just don't understand, because all the things you've done, to me, this should have been 10 years ago. It's my own fault, Mary.
You know, the thing is, I'll give you one little example. So when
you wanted to have a life.
Because when I got into the reserves here, and it was a drill sergeant unit that was here. They still have one here. Back then, they had two companies. I was one of the company commanders, and I was pretty comfortable. I was 5 minutes from the drill hall. I didn't have to drive 4 or 5 hours on a weekend to get to where I needed to go to do my duty. So I kind of got into a little comfort zone, happy being a captain a little longer than I should have. And when I went on active duty, and there's these young majors running around that I'm 10 years older and I'm still a captain, that kind of woke me up to say, all right, I got to get my career back on, you know, sure. My comfort level has to be challenged a little bit so I can move up in the ranks.
So now that you're a lieutenant colonel, what is your prospect for becoming full bird colonel?
I mean, it's really up to the Army. What I'm going to do at this point is right now I'm
you're
on
trying.
This. Sure. Yeah, I've done everything educationally that the Army requires to become a colonel, because that's one of the dividing factors, whether you get promoted or not. If you don't meet the education requirements, like Command and General Staff College to become lieutenant colonel, like I did that, so I've qualified me. If I hadn't done that, I would have never got promoted. So I've made all of the, you know, educational requirements. I've met all of those. To now it's just whether the Army needs more colonels at the time that I'm up for colonel. So that's totally up to the Army.
Well, there's always Kentucky Fried Chicken.
That's
if
right.
you're military career, they need a new colonel.
And you can still call me colonel, because if you're speaking, you know, a lot of times if you're a lieutenant colonel, they just say colonel whoever, and you know. I'll take either one.
You'll take either one. But you would have to admit your chances of becoming a general officer
very limited. You have to do certain...
How old are you?
I'm going to be 54 tomorrow.
Oh, well, happy advanced... So you're still young enough. You could be a general.
Yeah, I can serve until I'm 60. That's my... The Army sets a date, which is called your MRD, your mandatory retirement, and or mandatory retention.
But people serve after 60 when they're general.
Yeah, you have to make general to do that.
Oh, okay. So, if you don't make general
or
by
colonel,
the...
Colonel, I mean, there's some...
Well, if you need it, they keep you on.
Yes,
kind of like
yes.
the Pope or the bishop.
There's
you
some
know?
Ways, but currently right now, you know, there's a date, which is when I turn 60,
it's
where the Army says, thank you, but see you later.
So, starting tomorrow, you have 6 years until you expire.
That's right. my military service.
His military expiration date. He's got to make general, folks, in 6 years. So, I don't know. I don't know whether to wish a major conflict breaks out. I don't know what to hope. I want the best for you, Rob, but can you possibly get there during peacetime?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I just think that I'm happy with what I'm doing, and I'll just take it as it comes. I'll do what the Army asked me to do, which I've done for 30 years. So.
You suck up. That's exactly how they do it. We're heading up to the Ursa Farmers Cooperative after this military lesson. And when we come back from hearing about pigs and cows and stuff like that, we're going to learn about what's going on with the Historical Society, because they've got a lot going on. And Rob, now that he's not on active duty anymore, is here every month tell us all about it. So we're excited about that. We'll be back in a minute. We are back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD, and now that we know all about Lieutenant Colonel Rob Mellon's personal military history, it's time to turn to the Bicentennial Series 2025 speaker schedule put on by John Wood Community College and the Historical Society of Quincy and Adams County all this year. These discussions will be at the Mary Ellen Orr Auditorium at 48th and Harrison, out there at John Wood. You just had one of the best ones, and I couldn't go!
Very well.
Because it's always on the night of the park board, but that's okay. John Quincy Adams and the Corrupt Bargain, very well attended. Good
very
to hear.
Very well attended. Yeah, over 80 people, a really interesting conversation. And Dr. Belko is a very adamant Jackson supporter. And then we had some John Quincy Adams, obviously, supporters. So there was a lively discussion afterwards. It was nice.
Okay, well, you know, we should always take John Quincy Adams' sign. To heck with you, Belko, and your Jacksonian principles. The next one coming up is February 12th. Macy Ferguson Smith and Justin Coffey will be talking about Emma Coger and William Dallas. And these are interesting people in our law enforcement history, are they not?
Well, these are real heroes, and this is part of our Black History Month. Emma Coger was part of an early challenge to segregation. On the steamboat. So well before Rosa Parks, we had our Rosa Parks here in Quincy, and her name was Emma Coger. So if you want to find some more information about her, her life is going to be detailed on that night. And William Dallas is a real hero. He had fought as a black soldier during the Civil War in the 55th Massachusetts. He eventually made his way to Quincy, became the first black police officer in Quincy, on the Quincy Police Department. And he was killed in the line of duty and became the first black police officer in the state of Illinois to be killed in the line of duty. So he's a real hero, and that's going to be celebrated on February 12th.
And then, speaking of heroes, I love it. Arla Stittmer is going to give a talk called Another Nurse, Another War.
That's right.
And the one thing that every war has in common, I'm sure even up in your FEMA post, you had a lot of medical personnel.
Oh, absolutely.
That were ready, waiting, and willing to help you if there was that unforeseen event. What's Another Nurse, Another War about?
So this is a feature on a lady called Loretta Eno, and a lot of people know her because there's a building on Blessings Grounds called the Eno Building, and it's named after Loretta Eno. She was a nurse for a long time. This story is going to focus on her service at Pearl Harbor. So she was at Pearl Harbor during the attack.
Wow.
And so Arliss is going to talk about her life as a military nurse and then as a nurse here in our community for many, many years.
Well, tell Arliss that the thing I think a lot of people want to know, having seen the movie Pearl Harbor, which you don't have to read a history book, just watch movies. Seen the book Pearl Harbor, I'm being facetious there. They took out their lipsticks and put M on there if they'd already given them a hit of morphine because it was so, I mean, they were overwhelmed.
Yeah, sure.
And so they only had so much to go around. And so they actually, the nurses that ran out and were taking care of people were writing on their bodies with their lipsticks what they had administered to them because they didn't have any charts or any records or any way to keep all that. And they didn't want to give them two hits of morphine. It could kill them. But
that's
they also
right.
didn't want
yeah.
to give them two hits of morphine because they didn't have enough morphine and there were going to be a lot of need for morphine. So
yes.
that's going to be interesting. And then basically it's going to be, what is it? It's always Wednesday. It's the second Wednesday of
every
month. It was.
The first one had to be moved a little bit because of some scheduling. But from here on out, it'll be the second Wednesday at 6:30. And then the following morning, we're going to have a day after discussion because this first one generated a lot of discussion. People were really wanting to get
nobody
the
wanted
point
to leave
across.
John Wood, did they?
Yeah, so I thought, well, the next morning at 9 o'clock in our lounge, which the lounge is really nice at the Historical Society, it's a great place. We always have coffee in there. We're going to have donuts on those days. It'll be at 9 o'clock the day after, so that Thursday, and then we can have a discussion about whatever the topic was. And there was a lot of people who wanted to continue the discussion, I can tell you, on that first one. But that means it was a good program.
That is right. So after you've had a good night's sleep and chance to settle down, come the next morning on February 13th. We'll see you the day after at the beautiful lounge there at 12th and State in the Visitor Center right next to the Governor John Wood Mansion. That will be going on. So this is just part of what's happening. There's a bicentennial speaker series put on by John Wood. All the programs start at 6:30. It's the second Wednesday of every month. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful event. You also have your Sunday series continuing.
That's right.
You just had Matt Schuckman talk about sports greats of Adams County. What does he think is the greatest moment in Adams County history?
So do you know where Matt went to high school?
No.
He went to Quincy Senior High School. So in the history of Quincy Senior High School, what are they always talking about?
The 1981 Blue Devil. Was he a class of 81?
So no.
No, I was going to say my brother was.
You know, they hearken back to that time.
Oh, my God. I mean, Chuck Schultz goes crazy.
I'm proud of it, too, even though I'm a Notre Dame guy. I'm proud of that, too. But that was his number one. I will say in his defense, he thought that the run that the boys' soccer team that Quincy Notre Dame had in the early 80s was a great accomplishment because there was only one class. So when they won the state championship, when Al Knepler was the coach, and I was I was in high school at the time, so it was really cool.
Al Knepler was a former teacher of mine.
Yeah. So he thinks that
even though he's 12 years younger than me, Rob and I have a shared history.
But he thinks that would be in that top list too because they were the state champion. There was only one class at the time.
Okay.
So
well,
those were a couple.
The Raiders made it to fourth place in 1973 or 74. So the basketball Raiders. Of course, back when I was in school, this is how old I am, Rob. Girls weren't even hardly allowed to play sports. You could play tennis, you know, but no way. I remember Tia, what was her last name? I'll think of it. She wanted to be on the soccer team. And people were like, you can't do that. And I'm like, she could kick the butts out of everybody. But no, Tia Hopkins was her name.
Okay.
I remember.
All right.
I don't know what she's doing now, but at one time at a class reunion, she was an international interpreter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Very, very, very smart.
We've had a lot of impressive people go through
our
school systems here in the county.
We have. I don't know what happened to me, but yes.
Yeah, we didn't reach those levels.
We didn't reach those levels. But
some of us did.
But some of us did. Well, let's talk about what's happening because Matt Schuckman erroneously said that the 1981 Blue Devil team was the best thing that ever happened. I say it was, I don't know, when I won Tiddlywinks in my driveway. But Sunday, February 9th, a name that is now very common and people know because of, again, a movie, C.T. Vivian. He was very active at Western Illinois University,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he actually was born in Boonville, Missouri. And as a very young boy, moved to Macomb. So he grew up in Macomb, graduated from Macomb High School, then went to Western. Shortly after college, he gets into the sit-in movement, which at that time was right at the beginning.
Oh, and it was in the radical,
like the 40s is when he gets into the civil rights movement. That's pretty
dangerous.
Early.
Yeah, you could get killed for saying I want to eat at the Woolworth counter and I'm going to take over the president's office because, you know, black people aren't admitted to certain programs.
He was right at the beginning
of that.
That's right. He became a Baptist minister. He went to Nashville, and this is where he started to meet all these other civil rights, which we would consider civil rights heroes and icons of the time, including he'll meet Martin Luther King and become close friends with him, and he's part of the civil rights movement. All the major events you can think of the civil rights movement, C.T. Vivian is there, and Byron Odin Shabazz from Western is going to come down. He's the president and founder of the C.T. Vivian Project in Macomb. He's going to give a story or celebrate the life of C.T. Vivian.
So C.T. Vivian was very active nationwide in the civil rights movement and was at the side of many more famous leaders that we like Martin Luther King and people that
yes.
we know the names of now that are...
In fact, famous pictures, you don't realize it. If you pulled it up now, you're like, oh, there's C.T.
There he
Vivian.
Is. Yeah, but you know, again, if you don't know who he is, you wouldn't know that he was there.
Right.
I have to share with you, on Wednesdays, I mentor in a second grade classroom, and they were talking about Martin Luther King Day because they didn't have class, and then the snow canceled, so it was time to talk about Martin Luther King, and the kids are fascinated because I said, I was alive. I remember. I'm the same age as his kids, you know, and they're like, you must be 1,000 years old. I said, no, I'm only 999. But they were kind of fascinated that, you know, I had some firsthand knowledge. And boy, I tell you what, you want to talk about hard to explain? Explain to 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds about racial discrimination.
Yeah,
this is not something most of them have experienced. They
right.
might have heard a cuss word now and then or the N-word. And maybe some of them, hopefully not, are growing up in racist households. But by and large, they go to school with black kids, you
yes.
know, and they all sit in the same class. And it's really difficult to explain that.
Yeah, well, the reality is children do a much better job with racial relationships.
We have
than
to be carefully taught from
them.
South Pacific. You have to be taught before it's too late,
yeah.
before you're 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate.
I didn't know I was supposed to. Right.
And that is the best lyrics, isn't it, from South Pacific? You have to be taught before it's too late,
yes.
before you're 6 or 7 or 8. To hate all the people your relatives hate, you have to be carefully taught.
Yeah.
And you were talking about that Saudi Arabia thing. You know,
yeah,
if,
that's right.
I mean, the Hatfields and McCoys, if they're not of the family of Saud,
yeah.
we don't have to listen to them.
That's right.
Yeah. So
irrespective of rank.
Irrespective yeah. of rank. This yeah. is going to be Sunday, February 9th at 2 o'clock back at the Senior Center, where most of their programs are held on those Sunday afternoons. It's at the Senior Center because it's handicap accessible and it holds a large crowd, and we hope to get a large crowd. And it's just going to be absolutely fantastic. And then we also want to talk a little bit real quickly. The reason you have these things there is because you're not handicap accessible across the street, but you're working on that. And I've left you only about 2 minutes to explain the update on the new construction project across the street at 4th and Main on the Historical Society Museum.
Right. I think this is really important for the long-term viability of the building. Anybody that's walked into the building for any reason, for events or so forth, know how difficult it is to get in. It's kind of heartbreaking in some cases. We've had World War II veterans. We've had a World War II program upstairs that can't make it upstairs, and literally tears in their eyes because they can't get upstairs. And, you know, we figure out a way to try to get them upstairs. So that's just one example. Plus school kids that come in who have disabilities. You know, we have tons of school kids that come into our programs, whether at the mansion or the museum. And, you know, we don't have a capability to get those students in. And so this is going to change the dynamics. The bathrooms in there are horrendous. I would say...
I don't know. I never go... I don't drink a lot of liquid.
It's not wise to go to the bathroom in the museum.
It's not a good idea to have a lot of liquid.
Wait,
just wait till you get home.
You take a trip back in time to the 1950s, downstairs. But the new project will change some of those things, some new bathrooms, accessibility to all four areas of the building, and then a ground entrance, which is really important.
And, of course, this is all being made possible by private donations. And
we
need
you
need
help
it.
There.
You need
That's
it
right.
because your contractor, God love him, local contractor, has said, I'll do it. And you've been like, well, you know, the elevator needs to go all the way to the top. They can't stop after two floors. So don't quit building, Jerry Mast. You know, keep going. But it really is a labor of hope. So,
yeah, definitely.
So people, where can they send money?
They could send money to the Historical Society. You know, our number is 222-1835. That's when the mansion was built. So you can call us. You can go on our website, hsqac.org. There's some information on there about it. The reality is our organization has not had debt really in 130 years. And so
you don't want to have
debt. We don't want to have debt. So we have the ability. The building is going to be constructed because we've agreed to that. We just need some help to get there.
Okay. They don't want to have to take out a bank loan, so please give generously to the Historical Society of Quincy and Adams County. Lieutenant Colonel Rob Mellon, thank you for your time today.